welcome to the IsCast episode 27. I'm Lee Anderson. I'm followed here today by Wade Wojcik.
I'm following you.
Ben Robertson.
And tweet.
David Ishida.
Following you too.
It also should be noted that we have other people in this building that are loud. So
yep.
If you hear them.
We are in a new space that we just got. I am actually going to have Sean do a quick video for our YouTube people to show our new space.
Yes.
So just film us a little bit and then pan around. It's going to be kind of dark.
Yeah. They happen to be watching Interstellar. So if you hear any moments of extreme Hans Zimmer
yep.
and stuff.
So hopefully we'll be
Sean's filming in the back corner. It's very important.
Yeah. And about in the back.
You didn't need to get the whole space, Sean. Just like us.
And every single section of it.
It was just going to be a quick like,
yeah.
What's up?
Hey.
So hopefully we'll be filming stuff here more often and working on content and
yep.
having fun.
Being productive.
Oh, yeah. Yes, this is a space for us to work and play and hang out and drink. I guess there's a huge bar.
It's located here in North Minneapolis.
Northeast Minneapolis.
Northeast.
There's a difference.
Very big difference.
For some people.
Yes.
But on the right side of the river.
Literally, right side, yeah. Looking at the map.
Yeah, so other stuff going on in Minnesota that just happened recently in March was a video game conference.
Yes.
That is in its, how many years?
I don't know. I actually was going to ask you guys if you knew how long GlitchCon was a thing.
Five.
I thought you said it was just this was the first year.
Minnesota no. GlitchCon.
Oh, okay. Oh.
So, Wade, why don't you...
Well, here's the thing. I've never heard of GlitchCon before a few months ago, so I just assumed it was the first one.
When I posted about it, want you guys to go, and
yeah.
no one responded to me.
Yeah, sorry about
sorry.
That.
Except David.
But, yep. okay, David,
I'm on
please...
top of my shit.
David, please fact check me. Anyway, it was yeah. this video game convention that was at the U of M McNamara Alumni Center a couple weeks ago, or last week or something.
End of March.
Yeah.
Last weekend.
And I went as part of my work. There was a Game Informer panel talking about the importance of gaming culture and how games influence culture. But there was a lot of other really cool panels. And I think more than anything, for me, it was just really fun to see something like this in our own backyard, like in our hometown. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to go to Texas to
yep.
see
but
something
I
like
think
this.
I think what attracted to me reading about it, and I actually saw the ad on... they were advertising on Game Informer. That's mm-hmm. how I found out about it. But they really target the artistry or the making of video games
yeah.
or like the cultural impact of video games. And I think that matches what Minnesota. We have a very strong art scene here. And so I think that really matches the people here. And I like that more, I don't know, older... kind of tone of the conference
more than showing
I didn't get
content.
To go but I really want to yeah and maybe Wade can speak to some
yeah.
of the panels
why don't you?
Yeah good. So a couple of the panels they had like Sprite Acid and Effect Design for 2D platformers. They had a really cool panel that I didn't get to go to, but it was called Successes, Risks and Failures of the Local Indie Development. They had one that was the Audio Toolkit, Creating Music and Sound for Games. And they had other famous YouTubers like Ashley Birch. Hey, Ash, what you playing? She was there that did a panel. And also they had a lot of places in the convention to just hang out and play games with random people. Mm-hmm. It was a big social space where you could...
I think looking at the schedule, there was even like people one-on-ones of teaching you how to play League of Legends.
Yep, yep. Yeah. There was that. Also, a Hearthstone Fireside Gathering was the name of the gathering yeah, thing. There was also a really cool place in the social... I don't know, common area where you could go and rent out board games. They had a big table that was just stacked, all these old, like uncommon, but really cool board games that people could play. Yeah, there's a lot of Hearthstone League PCs set up. So it was a place cool. to game with, you know, strangers, but people who are as nerdy as you are. And then at the end of the first day, I saw this. It was really neat. It was the evening reception, an art gallery where they had video game art that was put on display, and they had like a best of show where they put on, you know, the winners of like, I don't know, the awards
those
of the
like
night.
Fan content, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so they coupled it with like a wine and cheese ceremony. So you go in and cool. have a glass of wine, some crackers and cheese, and walk around elegantly and look at video game art.
That's awesome.
It was just a really cool collection of video gaming culture, you know, the playing, the people who are interested in creating it. And also there was a really cool panel what was the name of the company? Yellow Cord. They do. Oh, I think Yellow Cord. Yeah, there were. He was the guy who did the sound and music panel. But he's from St. Paul, and he specializes in sound and music for like video game stuff. Cool. So there's actually it was almost weird to see. I felt like people came out of the woodwork almost for like creators of video games and that sort of mm-hmm. content, because you don't see a lot of that around here. But the fact that we had it, and the fact that I hope we continue to have it, is really refreshing to me, and I hope it continues.
Yeah, we'll have to go next year. It was also Game Informers. They did their first live replay.
Yes, which was fun. They did Overblood, which is a terrible, terrible, terrible game. But that's why I did it, because it's funny to watch people suffer through it. Cool. And it was really cool also to see, I guess, live feedback from audience members like Lee when we were in high school, getting live feedback from the show we did. When you do an internet show, you don't get to like listen to real-time laughter of an audience, so having that was really interesting. And that's what we got to encounter when we were there.
Yeah, you can also do like Q&As too after panels.
Exactly. And invite people to play with you, which is what they did as well. So yeah, it was awesome. Really cool. So hopefully that continues.
Yeah, and speaking of, they're kind of gaming related, Quarter Digital. We've mm-hmm. we've talked about them before, and we've helped out with some of their other videos that they've come back for.
They've done a lot of promotion for games that are coming out. Like they did something for DayZ. They've done a couple different videos, I think, for different Assassin's Creed games.
Yeah, they have like they have a huge partnership with Ubisoft. They've done the Assassin's Creed, Shadow of Mordor. I don't know if
Shadow of Mordor wasn't an official one.
No, Shadow of Mordor was. Yes. They did Assassin's Creed,
Black Flag
3, and Assassin's Creed.
Did they do 3? I didn't see that one.
Yeah, they did one for 3.
They filmed that one.
I did see that.
They did a Far Cry one, too. That was funny.
Did they?
50%. Yeah, it was like it was pretty loosey comedy-based kind of thing, where they dropped animals or something. Remember that? I don't know. Anyways.
do you guys think that these companies are going to Corridor because of their skills as filmmakers or because of their internet draw?
I think it's both. It's a huge trend now with companies. They're realizing the people are going on internet and watching things rather than going to a TV, and so they're trying to tap into that audience and market and stuff like that.
I was just watching their Black Flag one, and I got halfway through, and I just thought, I think this would have been so much better had it been done by, I don't know, a professional crew or something, you know, because I just felt like it was flat in the middle.
I think that was the one that didn't really draw me in too much. I think it really works well if they have something really unique and fun about it. I think the Far Cry one worked because they kind of threw a comedy twist and kind of made it fun.
Yeah,
I think that fits their style.
Kind of like Freddy W in the Nintendo one for Donkey Kong.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, going back to the
they were back again. They came back because they wanted snow, and Minnesota has plenty. Or we did.
This has the reputation for it. Right. Yeah. Towards the end of the couple of days, we definitely lost out on.
Yeah, it started getting
snow.
Warm, but it was great. You know, we just want to touch on how much fun we had. We helped them a couple days over the weekend, and
We
got
David,
to shut down a street in St. Paul, and that was the first time they've done that too.
Yeah. David hooked us up.
Because I helped them out 2 years ago now when it was the DayZ one. I went out for that evening and I made a connection with them as well as with Tim Lovett, who's another local guy who's up here and has worked with them in the past. And he shot me the email saying, "Hey, Quarter Digital's back in town. Can I give your name for them?"
And you recommended us too, so we got to be on the project as well.
Yep. Yeah. So everyone from Intersection at one point or another was on that shoot.
Yes.
Yeah, so we got Dave and Wade got to AC.
I also got to AC. Yeah.
Yep, we helped a little bit. I did second AC a little bit. We did grip, art.
Set design.
Me and Ben got to be extras.
Yeah,
right. You guys are in it. I think
hopefully we'll make the cut.
The first shots of the day that Saturday. I don't even, because David and I were in separate departments, so we didn't even talk to you guys until maybe like an hour into it. And all of a sudden, I see Ben and Lee running around in the shot, and they're like, "Oh, okay, yeah, they're going to be in it. Great." Totally. But yeah, I had the privilege of being the running buddy of Sam and Nico. They were running around with the Ronin camera, the Epic, and I got to be their AC, which was so much fun. And David was the AC on the other camera with the director.
I came with Adrian. Oh, I'm going to forget his last name, of course. It's like Bacardi, isn't it?
Bacardi.
Some awesome rum.
Puckardi.
Adrian Bacardi.
Oh, okay. Puckardi with a P. But he was a really fun guy to work with, too.
Yeah.
Everybody was great.
Mm-hmm. And they said, good crew. They said, "Don't take pictures on set," but David took a lot.
Bleep that, Sean.
Well,
everybody was taking pictures.
Jake was the production manager on set. He was cool with taking pictures as long as it didn't end up on social media afterwards.
I thought it was really funny that David, at the end of the second day of that weekend, took out your phone to take pictures, and then all of a sudden, like, Sam, Nico, and Adrian and the cast and people are, like, posing for you and your phone.
Yeah.
Yep. So, yeah.
I mean, if you want to take that out, we can.
No, it's fine.
So that was a lot of fun. I hope we get to do that more. Hopefully they come back to Minnesota.
Heck yeah.
One thing about it that was nice that they said was how cheap it was to get location and especially to shut down a street.
And relatively easy, too. It didn't seem like there was a whole bunch of bureaucracy that they ran into. We did a little bit the first day that I was on set. The space where they wanted to use, they had gotten the rights and permits by the city, but they didn't get any for the county, apparently. Mm-hmm. That was a thing. So one of the building managers came out and was like, hey, girl, you have to come out and do this. Like, got like really like ego-y and like, hey, just like, I want to shoot kids off of my space. Yada,
where
yada,
was
yada.
That?
Shoot, I'm going to forget it. It was, I think, in the northeast part of St. Paul. But yeah, I forget exactly what it was.
Great.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, super fun. I only got to be on set for 2 days.
6 days.
2 days for me.
Four.
Well, we all put in a great contribution. Can't wait to see it. It's going to come out hopefully soon.
Gathering too. Ben set up a event to get some of those people that, because there was a lot
reunion of all the Minnesota,
a lot of the
kids.
Crew and some of the actors too were from Minnesota. So
we're gonna majority of them were actually
they're really, really good. Cool. So,
but to your point, Ben, hearing how easy it was and cheap it was to secure some pretty interesting spaces in the cities, I think is kind of inspiring to us and. With how we're trying to schedule shoots that may be in the cities, we scheduled a shoot for our Halo teaser back in 2012 that was in two locations in Minneapolis, and we didn't really know how to go about doing it, and specifically because we had a guy in trooper armor with an assault rifle, but we ended up just shooting it. We nixed the assault rifle because we didn't want to get cops to like arrest us.
Yeah.
But that turned out fine because we were really quick. We only shot in each spot for like a half hour.
Yeah.
Despite cops driving by and looking at us.
Yeah.
No one ever saw
that. Still
us.
Happened on the corridor shoot too.
Did it? Well, yeah, but I mean they had like weapons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whereas ours looked much more futuristic.
No, I was like holding pedestrians back and a cop was there and was talking to him about it and how like the day before they actually got a lot of calls. Because it, they knew about it, they were able to.
Well, it was crazy too, because like they had a pyrotechnic crew on set.
That was
like,
awesome.
Yeah,
got to do squibs.
Oh yeah, we didn't.
Explosions and
the blood squibs were great. They had the effects crew rig windows to blow, or they said it was going to spider crack.
Yeah,
they just blew right out, and so glasses hitting me and Sam, who's holding the Epic on the Ronin, and yeah. Like once Adrian yelled cut, Sam like shoved the camera to me and he's like, oh, glass.
I definitely want to look into making squibs and
what
does it take? I don't know if you need to be licensed or anything.
I think it gets in some pyrotechnic stuff because you're dealing with the potential for significant injury. Anybody. I know one thing I remember from Rooster Teeth, when Bernie and Matt, their first movie, long before Rooster Teeth, called The Schedule, they made some squibs. And this is, to the viewers, do not do this. This is not how you make squibs. They took the firing cap for a shotgun shell.
Oh, a primer.
Yeah, they took that. And they were really, so like the guy, like, Bernie would like, he'd take it and cut it apart and like to make it and make sure that like test with what the force and like how much padding he had to have behind it. And one thing they were so worried about is they were worried about the person in like in front of this guy who's getting shot, like, if a little bit of something got into this squib and was thrown out. Yep. And what they found out later is actually the person who was at most risk was the guy who was wearing the squib.
Equal and opposite reaction.
Yeah, exactly. Like so do not do that. Yes. That's not how you make squibs.
Right. But the squib crew were set up right next to the camera department area. Mm-hmm. And so we got to see them make a little bit of it. And they basically just took like these plastic baggies and put some of the blood in it and sealed it.
Yep. I know the other one I really wanted
more technical than that.
But I know, but that's basically what they were doing.
Just a quick note though, like they did have like supervisors on set that were certified.
Yep.
Like, for all the squibs, this was all for all the stunts and everything.
They came all the way from LA.
Mm-hmm.
And the other cool thing that I want to try those days, they had the airsoft guns, or not airsoft, paintball guns with pellets that were filled with dust. So when you shot at, they were shooting at cars in this case.
My car.
It looks like, well, it doesn't look like bullet hits, because bullet hits don't look like that, but it looks like movie bullet hits.
Yeah,
right. And you got dust coming up from it. Yeah. And I know that's relatively simple to do that kind of stuff. It would be fun to try.
Yeah, I wonder if they're good at, because a lot of shots you could see the actual, like, shell going through the air. I wonder if they're gonna have to like paint all those out. I'm interested to see what kind of stuff.
The paintball shell.
It's really easy to actually make a trail. Cool, but how it actually dust. Like comes to an effect. Yeah. Yeah, it'll be interesting.
So speaking of explosions, down in heaven.
It's a terrible transition.
Yes, but we're going with it. Explosions.
Yeah, but epic movie. Back into filming with for us.
Snow's gone. Semi warm.
Yeah, we shot our first day of pickups back at the Livonia pit, and I'll say this because I looked at the footage, the location itself looks pretty much the exact same. Unfortunately, the sky was slightly different, and looking at the footage, the first time we shot there back in the fall, man, that looks really good in comparison. Just because of the even lighting of the clouds. Expectedly
it was overcast,
right? Because we shot in RAW, there's a lot of data we can pull. So I'm not worried about things being overexposed. There's still a lot for me to learn with Resolve, because I've been looking at tutorials, and I did what I thought was a pretty good grade to pull as much data as I could. But turns out there's a lot more you can do. And I was looking at it last night. Man, with RAW, you can pull basically everything out of there. The problem is with pulling data from the blacks, you can run into some grain issues. Yeah. But I'm still learning. So the light's a little harsher in some of the shots, but overall it looks really good, and it's going to make the scene a lot better. So that's great. Yeah, and we have a couple more days.
Yeah, we got three more days. A lot of stuff happening. We're getting into post more visual effects. We're hopefully going to be more working on some content for our backers and for just our fans. We're going to be working on a Vlog.
We
haven't done that in a while.
Yeah, that will hopefully. I don't know when this podcast is going to get posted, but it will be out soon.
And now that we're, focusing more on posts than we are in production, I'd like us to do more Vyblogs, more regularly scheduled Vyblogs.
Yeah.
Because for a while we were on the bi-yearly schedule. Like every 6 months we would do a Vyblog. Yeah. And at this point, we're probably beyond that. So back when the summer that Lee and I started doing all this crap, there was a point where we were doing one every week.
Really?
And it was, Yeah, one Vyblog a week, and it was mostly talking about random progress we had in our armor, and then Reach news, because Reach was coming out.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
You got Lee's corner.
This is like
we need
episode.
To bring that back.
No, it was like two or three.
Was it?
Oh, yeah, we got to bring that back. That. We totally got to bring that back.
So the other thing too is people seeing the Vyblog will see this. The weather was crazy.
Oh, the storms.
We had a severe wind advisory, I think is what it was, and it was sustained winds of 25 to 35 miles an hour and gusts to 60.
We set up like the best like tent base camp we'd ever set up to that point, an easy up with tarps on all the walls, and they were weighted down and all the gear was in it, and
it was nice. Like we were contemplating having lunch in it too.
Not all the gear. Luckily,
right.
Not all.
And then, we're out at lunch, and David's at base camp. We get a text from him. We are evacuating
base camp.
Get back to base camp. Yeah, the easy up is just wrecked, and we had to improvise. And then the clouds went away for shooting. But overall, not too bad. It could have gone a lot worse, and I think we got a lot of good stuff out of it.
It's crazy how, we started this, and Halo Reach was coming out, and that inspired a lot of like the armor and weapons, and now we're on to Halo 5 coming out already,
but I will argue we got the best models in the series.
I love their look and design. I would say that the Halo 3 over 3 armor stuff still bugs me. It's still, I don't know,
it's
bubbly.
Busy. It's busy. Yeah. It's very busy.
Yes. Kind of crisis.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good way.
Like
to look
nothing's
at
really
it.
Connected anymore. It's just like pads or of like
it's elements of armor that are unified by the undersuit.
Yeah.
Which, with gaps that sometimes I feel like there are gaps that are too big for anyone in their right mind to design armor that way. There's a huge gaps like on Master. It's someone like where like their entire top of your shoulder was open and like the armor didn't start.
There's an energy
shield.
Yeah. It, which well, but still, you could argue, but from a look aesthetics. Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't necessarily agree with that.
If you didn't have a shield, it wouldn't seem like the armor looked very functional.
Your shield
functional.
Still goes down in the games.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. But, right, I do remember when Red versus Blue first showed off some of the Halo 4 armor. They did an episode talking about when Halo 4 comes out, and they had the new, like, helmet.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the name of it, but I remember thinking, that's the stupidest helmet I've ever fucking seen.
Yeah, so they're ramping up their marketing. They have some new... something they have they've always done tricky stuff with Halo, but they posted this website on Tumblr. They're kind of mimicking this reporter that's in the future, and he's reporting on Master Chief, and he's discovering,
yeah,
you know, secrets and kind of exposing,
almost reminiscent of the I Love Beast thing, but more explicit, more like, yeah, this is Halo.
This is definitely more public too. The I Love Beast was kind of like a secret, like Bungie loves their secret, like doing things without telling anybody, but definitely this was tweeted out and,
yeah,
you know, people found it right away. But
yes, and two live action trailers, one released with Locke and then the other released about 30 minutes later with Chief, and sorry, that was my mind exploding.
Well, because like they were the same thing more or less,
just
because roles reversed,
because their tagline right now is hunt the truth, and there's two sides to every story.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to be very interesting to see how they use that. I've heard interesting concepts that they could be maybe making the game, you know, where like Halo 2, where you got to play as the Arbiter, but maybe even more so pushing that to where you play the same stuff and it's not always what you thought it was the first time you played it.
So and you play the same level twice, but it's different each time.
Maybe, or, you know, just the same, you're in the same event, and by being a different character and being in a different situation,
oh, yeah,
it reveals a different side of the story. And right. I thought that was an interesting idea that could be maybe work. I definitely think I want them to push the single player and make it really unique. Multiplayer, great, you know, solid. You know, they had beta, they're going to do another one. That's a really staple of the game. They don't need to change that much. But I think that they should have some flexibility with the single player now and maybe offer some new mechanics.
Yeah.
I think my biggest issue with these recent Halo games is that I just kind of wish that 343 didn't have to do Halo. I wish Halo died, to be perfectly honest. Like,
would you say, though, that it did with Halo 3? Like,
no,
that
no, it didn't.
That as a story and a self-contained series of games by Bungie... from the developer.
Okay, so that's fair. I think
it's kind of contained within itself.
Let me modify that statement. I wish that they let Master Chief die. I wish that they just stopped touching that, because I don't know. When you look at Microsoft in general, I feel like they're just kind of whoring out Halo. Because like you look at
Cortana,
Cortana, Project Spartan, you know, trying to make as much money off of Halo as they possibly can. But like going back to like. To the root of the discussion, I think that, you know, Master Chief, he was more of a symbol and less of a person. Because I think like even Bungie talked about that in some of their
interviews.
Yes, he was
very much a symbol.
Yeah, like the symbol of like the unfailing hero, not so much the perfect soldier, but the unfailing hero.
Well, he was a symbol for the player,
and that's the main premise of this new game. It seems like is that idea and how, you know, breaking that down and what does it mean and actually getting into Master Chief as you know, as a person, as a, you know, that he's not perfect.
And I think that's one thing, though, that I sort of enjoyed about it, because I read I don't remember if it was a book I had read about it, and about how Halo changed I think it wasn't a book. I think it was called, like, How Halo Changed the World. And it was a book examining, I think it was released after, I don't know, I think it was after Halo 2 or something. I don't think it was as late as Halo 3, but it was examining the impact that Halo has had on various levels with the gaming industry. And one thing they talked about that was so interesting, and one of the reasons, and I think, Ben, you've talked about this before too, of one of the reasons that Halo is such an interesting, and the Master Chief specifically is such an interesting character for us, is he is the unfailing hero in like every other piece of media that involves super soldiers, comic books, TV shows, movies, everything. The super soldier, usually at some point in their arc, and they start to question why they became super soldiers, why they're doing what they're doing. It's all this stuff is coming into question. And from Halo 1 through 3, the Master Chief never had that thing. It was always about his duty to the UNSC, to humanity, and that stuff. And it's like, and that what his duty to protect and save people is what always came first.
Yeah, I think they moved that responsibility of that story component to Cortana when she started getting rampant and like questioning things, who she was, things like that. They left all that part. Like I view Master Chief and Cortana like in those games as one character. Like and that's why I hated in Halo 3 when they got rid of Cortana, because then it's just like I was like, what's the point of this? Like, yeah. Why am I fighting?
Trying to find her.
I guess exactly. Different as different people.
Yeah.
Like they were a team, but they were different. Like Cortana seemed to have much more of a personality, mm-hmm. whereas Master Chief.
But they're almost two halves to a whole.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. You get both components, but together that's what made it special. And if you separate that, then if you don't have that human component, I don't really care like about this person I'm playing. That's what I got with like Call of Duty when they didn't, or even Battlefield, they just skip around. Like you're like all of a sudden you're in this little mission on this one story and this one soldier that you never knew about before until this very moment.
Yeah,
and I just like didn't care about it, and I didn't care about what I was doing.
There are some subtleties in Call of Duty though, like the one of the characters that you play in Call of Duty 2 shows up like his kid.
Certain games obviously did it better than others, but as a whole, no, I didn't like skipping around like that. And but I think from a story perspective, what I like and I hope it keeps trending is. I hate the episodic of like TV shows where they would just be the same, you know, comedy TV shows where just each episode is essentially the same thing just over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Or even some of the like cartoons, like nothing really progresses. It's just a little skit every time, each episode, just a different topic and the same thing over and over again. And with new shows like HBO series and Netflix, where they're very self-contained, smaller, but they progress, the characters evolve, things happen, things change, you actually get somewhere. I like to see that in games more, and I'm hoping they do that with Halo, where you know, that game of itself can't be compared to anything else because that's the only time that specific event happened.
I agree with you because I do like that. I like the idea of having things self-contained. I like the idea, at least with Netflix, you know, with their TV shows, they don't have a pilot system. It's just you make it, you do the entire story for the entire season or whatever, and then that's it. And then if it's good, okay, you do another one. But you have a complete story arc. I like the idea in games. However, with Halo, they should have just finished with Master Chief, let him be a part of history, create new characters. Because then, like, if you want to keep using the world of Halo, great, fine. That sounds like awesome. We need something else besides Star Wars to be like the main go-to.
But from a business perspective, and to make the series successful and to make money, you have to start off with something that people recognize, and therefore I think what they should do is continue with Master Chief, but use that and leverage it to push other characters. And I think they're doing that with Star Wars. You know, why not leave Han Solo, Luke Skywalker, and the other films?
Yeah.
Like, leave it be. They already did it once and it failed, but they need that. They need that draw, that the familiarity of those characters to then boot other sequels where there's going to be a female main actor and to get interest back into the series.
There's a great discussion, a small discussion about that on a YouTube video called What If Star Wars Episode 1 Was Good?
That's a great one. Belated Media. Go watch it.
Yeah. It's really fantastic. But he talks about how the episode one could have been good. You can still like draw people in. You know, sequels or prequels are interesting because you have to create something new, but then still tie it in with whatever is old. Episode one obviously failed that.
Yeah, but. And even the Star Trek, they kept a lot of the same story elements of the older films.
Mm. Yeah,
and just kind of reused them.
Did they now?
You're getting into a realm.
Okay,
let's not go there.
Lee, I will disagree with you on one point, in that I don't think you need Chief to make that connection. I think you need the Halo brand. But the case in point,
Chief is the brand.
The case in point would be ODST. Chief isn't in that game.
I don't believe is viewed as successful on a grand scale, on a very marketed fan basis.
Was it not successful? commercially?
It probably was, but I don't think a lot of people...
For a lot of people, they believe that it's the worst Halo game.
Yeah. No, I hear that all the time.
And so I don't. It just sucks. I think it's
the story sucks. So didn't understand it.
So hold on. So you think that the only way to make a Halo game is with Master Chief as the core character?
I'm saying from their perspective, to make a successful game right now with the current what it is, you need Master Chief.
The argument is that the brand isn't Halo. The brand is Master Chief.
At this time.
What I think they should have done is they should have done Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where Master Chief is Sean Connery. No, hear me out. So they're setting up a new character, and obviously that's, so the new character is Locke. I'll just say, to put it in the context of Halo 5. The new character is Locke. You're going to play as Locke, and then the Master, and maybe it's still a mystery story about the Chief. Where did he go? Maybe he disappeared after the Cortana thing in Halo 4. And then, but the majority of the story is Locke, and he only comes in at the very end, and then that's the transitioning away from Master Chief. And it's moving to Locke.
And they could still do that, and I think that's a great idea. But I still think at least a couple of the missions you have to play as Master Chief.
I disagree. I think that if you really want to move on from, if you really want to create a new series, you have to move on.
ODST sold 6.3 million units.
Like, how much did it cost versus how much did it make?
Compared to what?
Well, it used the same engine as Halo 3, and they made it in a year with a small team.
How much did Halo 3 sell?
I can look that up too.
Well, I just like you say a number, just you kind
of. I get the idea of like,
right, but I mean that's not, you know, a small amount of money.
I get the idea of like using something familiar to branch off. It was like a good example is with the first Half-Life game. There was a mod that ended up being bought out by Valve, but it was called Blue Shift. And the entire game was basically Half-Life 1, following through the entire game, but different events, different levels, different maps.
12 million.
You played as a different character. You played as a security guard versus being Gordon Freeman. It was very interesting. Like experiencing the same events in different places in the world. But yeah, interesting.
So looking at it, assuming that for all those how many was it for ODST? 6.3?
Mm-hmm.
6.3 million at $60 a game.
They're not all, I'm sure some of them were like on discount later.
Yes. But still looking at it, that's $378 million.
Yep. All right.
That's why gaming
they also
is
did sell
huge.
It with a map pack for Halo 3.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I don't completely disagree with you, Lee. I think from a business standpoint, yes, obviously it makes more sense to use the Chief because he's so recognizable. He's like one of the most recognizable characters in gaming. And I know that 343 is one of their main complaints about Bungie was that they killed off so many characters, so they couldn't use them. The Sergeant, Miranda Keys, you know, all those characters.
Yep.
But I will say, yes, I liked Halo 4. The campaign, I like where they're going, but I would like it more if it wasn't Chief.
Mm-hmm. See, I'm cool with them dying. Look at Game of Thrones; they kill off for George R. R. Martin kills off so many characters. Yeah.
But then they have to make new characters.
Their job harder. You know, they have to we have to use this character as long as we possibly can, keep pouring them out for money and stuff like that. No, come on. I mean, as much as 343's job is to expand Halo and make it their own. Yeah. I mean, just
no. I'm not disagreeing.
Actually, make something your own. Don't make it. Your own.
We agree with you.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing. You can't do that, but I think you need to leverage the Master Chief to do that. It can't just be like boom. He's gone. We don't know what happened.
I honestly thought they were going to do that with Lasky. Like it really felt like they were trying to make that connection. Right, with Forward Unto Dawn, with his presence in Halo 4, however
they
small
could have
done it was,
a lot
they could Lask have
was terrible in
right.
That game.
Yes. But I'm saying they set it up to do that. And
What I do like, though, with 343 is they are really big fans, and they are incorporating a lot of additional elements of the universe that are from like books and stuff like that that I love. And I hope they continue and get into, especially with like the was it Life Giver or
the Forerunner elements?
Didact. And just those characters. I hope they keep expanding, especially the what's the sub thing that you played, the fire fight stuff,
Spartan Ops,
where they had the episodic, like if you watch those are actually really good.
They are cool.
And I hope that it seemed like they were setting up a really big story with
Halsey. And the White Hand of Didact.
That could be really big. And I hope they continue that.
Yeah, and I totally agree. Although something in me feels like 343 has not transcended the barrier from fans to creators.
That's a good way of looking at it.
And that's what I'm scared of, is because with the video content, you know, even though Ford Unto Dawn was okay, they haven't been successful.
Yeah,
with other, besides maybe books, some of their motion graphics are pretty good, but I don't think that's not a very big medium.
They haven't done Halo in a way that it was done before. Like, they haven't if Halo 4 was released like on its own, as like if it wasn't attached to the previous games, if they just made that, I don't think it would have be as successful.
Yeah.
Ben, so I think Ben is
have something.
Doesn't like, or my question was, are we okay with Master Chief having feelings?
No, it's not, because it destroys the symbol.
We should have a debate about this.
Yeah.
Well, that part was supposed to be our debate.
Oh.
Yeah. I have it written down here.
No, yeah. I honestly don't think it's okay. I think that if they wanted to expand, if they wanted to bring more humanity into it, they could have done something without their own character. Because, like, Master Chief is much bigger than 343. It's much bigger than like the other, like, new game, whatever they're gonna do. Like, as you said, David, Master Chief is, what did Halo do to the world? What did Master Chief do to the world?
And
go ahead, David.
I was gonna say, and the other thing, when you look at the history of the Spartan program, all of the Spartan programs, look at Spartan Ones, or Project Orion, I think technically is what that is, which is Johnson, who was chosen for it, so that he has some augmentation to his body. I don't remember what it is. The Spartan 2s were the unique ones of all the farthest for Spartans. The Spartan 3s that are in Halo
Reach.
Yep, you see something. The Spartan 4s that are in
Halo 4.
Halo 4. Thank you. And if Locke is a Spartan 4, I bet he's a Spartan 4. I don't think they'd get into Spartan 5. When you look at the difference between all of them, the biggest thing is the Spartan 2s, I believe, were the only ones that had them taken as children. Yep. They were taken as children, and they had clones placed and put back in them. So the government, the UNSC, stole the kids.
Oni.
They also.
Oni. Oni. Yes.
They also had a surgical augmentation, where the other ones were just chemical.
Yep. Yeah. So they had a ton of crap done to them. And when I think about those Spartans, I try and think about, what if I was a kid that at 6 years old or 7 years old, I was taken from my parents, and then I was subjected to military rule for 15 years, and what that would do to me. Like, and I wonder, like, because you don't have any of those exact, like, you would not have a normal emotional and psychological development, because you're not subject to the normal nurture and that your parents or guardians would give you. You are under military ideology, and that idea of duty would be so ingrained, and such a core part of your personality would come from that 15 years of being in the military.
And that's why I like the idea of exploring that concept. And because I viewed him as Master Chief, John was part of the program. He was the most
well-known,
suited to accept those changes and be a leader and be that perfect soldier, and everybody else was okay, but they were still kind of remembered more of their past and what they used to be. But he accepted that the most. So I like the idea of, because I already got the action Master Chief action games of Halo 1, 2, and 3. So I got that. He's old now. He's getting really old. He's breaking down. He's, you know, he lost a caring companion. There's great dynamics of Halsey as a mother figure, but she could be going down a path that he might not agree with, or others from a human nature standpoint. So there's just a lot of really good concepts there, and like you said, this struggle of where he came from in his past, from going through this really tough program. And I'd love to expand that in from a game format.
And that's a really good point. I'm on the fence. I really liked what they did with Halo 4 and his struggle with trying to save Cortana, and how he will apparently still try and recover her in some way. Although, and I mentioned this earlier, when I think about the most fun I've had as Chief, it's been kicking ass in earlier Halos.
Do you think you're don't know what the right word is, taste has changed since then? Because that was, well, how old were you, like in Halo 2?
16.
Do you think you view that game differently now and expect something like different content now?
I guess.
Rather than that type of
game?
Yeah,
I mean, as we grow, we tend to, you know, appreciate and expect more meaningful cinematic content, which I think Halo had. I don't think the earlier Halos had as much meaningful drama as Halo 4 had.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was pretty casual and laid back in the early Halos. You know, if you compare Halo 1 and 3, they obviously ramped up the emotional resonance of certain scenes between those. And it's been going up. I guess for me right now, though, it's as much room as there is for Chief to have more of an arc. I think it would be more effective for me if they expanded on other characters in the Halo universe having,
yeah,
you know, emotional things. I think it's harder for me to identify with Chief in that way because I think of him as this machine of war that, you know, I guess is just, you know, fights for duty and for Cortana. Mm-hmm. And I could eat my words, who knows? Yeah. But I guess
and,
right now I'm on the fence.
And maybe I'm quite affected by the books I've read.
Yeah.
Because I haven't read all of them, but I've read a few and they definitely, you get a different sense of what he's been through and the companions he's had and has lost a lot.
So like in Fall of Reach, I think.
The Fall of Reach, yeah. And basically, mm-hmm, at that point, he got separated from all his other Spartan 2, you know, people he grew up with his whole life for 40 years. And until that point, lost contact with all of them.
Yeah.
And only had Cortana from that past. So there's elements like that that I've been exposed to that really affect my view of Master Chief.
Yeah, and you're right, and I think everyone would be more prepared to accept that arc with Chief having read those books. I do like how in Halo 4 they tried to bring in some of that by in the very beginning interrogating Halsey and talking about what the process was of like how she got the Spartan 2s.
Yeah, where that was their way of exposing some of those, yeah, elements.
And I think they should do more of that.
Yeah,
because I think it would do like with what you were talking about, like, mm-hmm, friends dying.
Yeah, and I think they are doing, you know, with the Hunt of Truth, you know, like they're releasing it on SoundCloud. I haven't listened to episode 2 yet, but they're in other ways they're trying to give exposure to some of that background.
Yeah,
trying to set people up for the game.
So,
which I think is a good idea, but a lot of people tend to not,
okay,
read that stuff and listen.
Yeah,
I guess we've all weighed in. It sounds like yes, kind of no, kind of I don't know.
We'll see.
Kind of we'll see.
I think it's going to be a risk, and hopefully it plays out
right. And you know, going back to my little soundbite, hopefully 343 can transcend the barrier of fans to creators, really own the universe. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Though the amount of bro-ness in the
there's a lot of bro, there's a lot of bro-ness,
me.
Yeah, especially in,
they did say they're gonna turn it down.
I feel like they're just getting hung up on like we need to make Halo our own instead of just taking like the core values of what made Halo good in the first, yep, place.
Yeah,
though it seems like, you know, they got a lot of, they worked on writers, they got a lot of writers, they got Jason back.
I took so, it from Destiny.
You mean Joseph?
Joseph, sorry.
I was, yeah, like, I knew what you were talking,
Jason,
about.
Jason Jones?
Yeah.
He's the other Bungie guy.
Mix those, he's two guys up. Destiny.
Yeah, but who knows? Who knows if he's going to be working on the games, but he's, yeah,
I'm sure the game was already too far at that point.
Oh, yeah,
to
sure,
get his input. But I think they identify that they need to do better. So
they should just hire us.
So I think one of the, we're talking about the broness, yeah, the main thing that I noticed was during the beta, the post game, like, oh, what's up, dude, hey, look at me, we are my team won kind of animation, yep, with the team. Yeah.
Yeah, wait, come on, we're all nerds here, we don't want to be the jocks.
Yeah,
I'm just saying.
Yeah, so we couldn't think of how to transition this from Halo. There's Interstellar.
Yeah.
Picture in your minds that we are sitting and then suddenly your vision is letterboxed. And now we transition into aspect ratio.
No, my transition was how Halo, what they did a really good job, because Bungie always does in-game cinematics, they didn't do that with Halo. Is that the first time they'd...
Halo 1 had in-game cinematics.
Yep. They also had letterboxing, too.
I'm trying to remember if Halo... I think Halo 4 did both. They kind of had like that pre-show type of thing with Blur Studios, and then they did like, yep, in-game stuff, too. But... I always liked how they're like, all right, you're pay attention to this, the story element, and then the letterbox goes up and it reveals the game controls or the, you know, you got your radar and stuff.
I really
like that.
Enjoyed that whenever you, in the first Halo, whenever you went from one section of the level to another, it kind of gave you the title of whatever that section was. Yeah. So it was kind
and
of like
they were
foreboding
fantastic
whatever
titles.
It was. Yes, they were.
You're like, I would have been your daddy.
Yeah. Like, or something more serious too. It was all just like, give you a hint of yep. like what was coming next.
Yeah. That really wants me to get into story elements and Destiny as a game, but what we're talking about here is we watched a video from two videos. What channel was that? IFC?
Oh no, it was from Film IQ.
Film IQ.
It's on Vimeo.
They had some great videos about the history of frame rate and aspect ratio,
mm-hmm.
and just kind of how it developed over the years and why we have
16:9.
2.351 why we have
2.351
or 2.351 whatever that one is.
2.35
Sorry.
Just 2.35.
You can say it different ways. That was the point of the video. But and also frame rates, why we have, what is it, 29.97
2398.
Yeah, all the
where
all
we
these
have
different
all those things. 25 versus 24. 60 so, base or 30 base, depending.
We'll try to link to it. Check it out. But I wanted to talk about it. It made me really think about, should that be, because before it was never really, we didn't have the luxury of choosing that. It was just based on, you know, the semi-expensive camera we picked up, and it by chance had 30i or, you know, whatever we had to work with.
Or it shot in 60i, but it had like a mode that could mimic 24 that kind of looked like it based on some weird shutter.
Exactly. So like we were really limited by
that aspect, and
we, you know, just kind of accepted that was just what we got. We got 16:9 because, you know, we're dealing with not broadcasting it or some of those other elements. So, you know, I just kind of want to discuss about, you know, what, now that, you know, maybe we have more control about that and, you know, picking lenses,
frame rates and all that business,
anamorphic, you know, especially the aspect ratio, I think is probably the most noticeable of an impact to me when I watch a film. I really like, what was the one, Lawrence of Arabia, what was that popular, do you know that format?
Cinemascope. Great. 235.
I think that's actually an aspect ratio that really resonates for me from a film perspective.
Cinematic perspective.
Like,
what was the question you were asking? You said, now that we have these options,
like, should that be part of our discussion of how much does it impact the way we tell our story visually?
Immensely.
And should we be more conscious, yes, of it? And especially like,
this is the guy who says, no, we must use these lenses. It makes all the difference in the world.
It does.
And you know, 4.3 is actually, I don't know if it's a good thing it's coming back. People,
how is it coming back?
Because it's like hip now, like it's been gone for a while, and Wes used it better from a story element for his Budapest hotel, where, mm-hmm, specific time, like he chunked his film in like the time.
Who else uses
it? Just from like indie perspective and,
huh,
and just different formats, or, you know, people shooting iPhones and things like that.
Well, the whole thing with 4.3 will come back, and for the same reason that widescreen came in. Because to really, really briefly, so with aspect ratio, everything was 4.3.
IMAX.
Everything. So originally, film was in 4.3, and then TVs came out, and everybody started getting a TV, and then everyone's like, why would we go to a movie theater when we can, if you will, see the same thing on a TV? So then that's when filmmakers started to explore the options of widescreen and doing things wider than basically, for all intents and purposes, a square image. And so now I'm saying is, we are now inundated with basically what everyone expects is 16:9 as an aspect ratio. And so with that, now that everything is 16:9 and everyone gets yelled at if they shoot 16:9 vertically, I wonder if 4:3 is going to come back because now we don't have 4:3 things.
It's a way to break your experience and you know, more from an artist perspective of like, hey, let me really screw up what you're used to and show you something new.
Is that
maybe even if it's not new, but
people doing 4:3, is it like the screen is slowly becoming vertical? It's slowly becoming squished.
Well, it's funny actually. No. in the Wizard of Oz one that just happened, Oz the Great and Powerful. That one, James Franco.
Yeah.
They did a transition. The movie started in 4:3 until they moved to
in
Oz,
black
and then when they hit Oz, yeah, it went back to.
I remember that
widescreen.
That's an interesting point. I remember. I thought nothing of it. The widescreen versus 4:3. Comparison, but before people had HDTVs, back when Lord of the Rings was on DVD, they had two versions. They had the regular and the widescreen edition. And when they were promoing the widescreen, they showed you what you were missing. Like what?
Yeah.
And the shot that they kept going back to was the 9 ring wraiths when they were humans getting the rings.
Mm.
And it was like, oh, you can only see like 5 on
the
normal.
Full screen editions?
Yeah, the full screen. That's what it was. Full screen versus widescreen.
Yep. And I remember even growing up, my family, like we did not have the 5-screen TV. We didn't have that luxury, and we had a normal full screen tube TV, but we always only ever got widescreen, even though we lost so much space.
Yeah.
We would only ever buy the widescreen.
I always got full screen because I thought like I enjoyed having the full screen TV. It wasn't until I started watching like things or seeing occasionally seeing things widescreen that I started really kind of appreciating it as that.
Because that's even my point is the format I like, the 2:3:5, like even on a normal widescreen now is still letterbox because it's more widescreen.
Unless you get an ultra wide monitor.
Unless you get an ultra wide.
Going back to your point, Lee. Now that we have the options of doing these different viewing experiences, I do like the 2:3:5 better than 16:9. To me, it does a much better job of directing the eye from a cinematic standpoint, mm-hmm. especially when framing up, you know, close-ups of people in like shot reverse shot dialogue or like framing someone up, you know, and gauging their performance. It just, I don't know. For me, when I see that aspect ratio versus something like 16:9 or bigger, it makes it more intense, like looking at someone.
I think you can set up movement a lot better, really focus on maybe a side of the screen for the actors, but then set up maybe something else in the background on the other side, where when you're doing a square, it's a little harder to have that separation of content.
And I would, before you butt in, David, I just wanted to say that I want to try and see if we can do that aspect ratio with Thunder.
What are our limitations for the Blackmagic?
Well, the thing with the Blackmagic is Blackmagic and the, like, 2:3:5 and using anamorphic lenses works really well because a lot of times it's moving a rectangular image to a square one, and it's squeezing it down.
And that was because of the film strip.
Yeah.
Had only so much space, and they had to make room for audio,
which is
too
comparable because our sensor only has so much space.
Yeah, exactly. and so the thing is, our sensor is a 16:9 sensor, so it sets to that default aspect ratio inherent in the imager. And like I was doing an experiment the other day, I pulled out a lens piece called the Mesmerizer, and it basically, if you go to Google, look up anamorphic lens, you'll see that the front element of that lens and what it looks like. Picture that I can put on to the front of almost any lens. When we did that, we went on to a 16. We were going on to a 16:9 sensor on the Alexa. Because our Alexa is a 16:9 sensor. So in a certain extent, it's not quite the same because it doesn't do quite the same squeeze and whatnot.
But just hearing us talk about it, I asked earlier, like, what's the difference between regular and anamorphic?
Yeah.
But I think I get the idea. So it basically, like, letterboxes it, but stretches it.
Yep.
So when we push it back together, it's like almost like a higher pixel density, right?
Wrong direction. So you if you're watching this, look at your computer screen. Your computer screen is more than likely around a 16:9. It's a rectangle. Now picture you're taking that, and put your hands on the left and right side of your computer and push your hands together. That is anamorphic. You are squeezing the same image on the horizontal axis and pushing it narrower, and then that is recorded under the sensor. And back in the film days, then you had to have a special projector to de-squeeze it, a special lens to stretch it wide.
Essentially, you're using the lens to fit into a 4x3 format on a film strip.
Yeah, so you're getting wider area, that's squeezed really cool. narrower, and looking at it when I did this quick test, and it looks beautiful. The you know, anamorphic has a lovely, lovely quality to it, and that's why a lot of people use it. And like an anamorphic, like if you wanted a airy anamorphic lens, $40,000 a piece. At the low end, probably.
Wow.
And you know, there's some other options, and I've actually because after watching this video a week ago or whenever it was, I actually started looking into a bunch of anamorphic options and how one could do anamorphic. What you could do to cheat it is you take a 16x9 image and you letterbox it.
That
sort of fakes it. But again, you're losing that that information above and below. Whereas if you use a lens and you're getting it all in the get-go. And
the image is that much richer.
Yeah, it's that much richer. You're not losing any pixels. And then I said the way that it handles flares and bokeh is this lovely, again, instead of being a circle for bokeh, it's this oval, and it has this wonderful quality to it.
Yeah.
And then looking back at movies like Lawrence of Arabia or these things that were shot on that wide angle, they just have this wonderful, wonderful cinematic look to them.
Is there any chance of shooting anamorphic for pickups that we have to do still?
I could try and swing it. It would introduce some interesting challenges. We can talk.
Okay. Well, I'm just putting it out there.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make a point. Like we should. I think really think about how we shoot our content. How you know, it just kind of opened my eyes up to some more of the technical aspects, but it also showed me from the history standpoint of how it wasn't really an artist pick to do 24 frames per second. It was a cost of film. Like, what was the lowest frame rate we could do using the shutter wheel thing to give a good enough playback that didn't have a lot of flicker and stuff like that, but not cost a lot of film. Well, so
wasn't it also to match the sound? Because didn't they switch?
It was a number that could be easily divided for editors. So like half of 24 is 12, half of that is 6, 3. Until you get to 1.
Yeah, it became with Edison, because Edison was the founder of sort of the modern film industry as we know it. And him looking at it, and I think with his calculation, he said that frame rate as we should know, film is the illusion of motion. The idea of moving pictures is...
I'm trying to follow you, David. You start a sentence, then you start another sentence, then you start another sentence, like halfway through.
Yeah. Okay, so film is an illusion. The idea of moving pictures is false because the pictures aren't moving. They're tricking our minds into thinking they're moving.
Yep.
And what Thomas Edison figured is to make sure that there are enough pictures coming at the right rate. I think it was 48.
48. Yep.
48 frames per second, which is why it looks like it does when we watch 48 frames per second projected movies. But as Lee was saying, they wanted something cheaper because film was expensive. Okay.
So is 48 the optimal frame rate?
That's the minimum frame rate for our human eyes. To watch sequential pictures and don't get any flicker in the motion or motion blur. It's just a very smooth, natural.
I wonder if that'll come back, because I don't know if it was recepted well.
Well, that was my point. Is you know, it's really like a side effect of it is we got used to it and you know we enjoyed the experience.
Yeah.
But it wasn't about it was a technical thing. So that makes me think like, oh, maybe, you know, 48 isn't a, you know, bad thing, or, you know, like things like that should be explored more, even like 60 frame per second stuff for video games.
And it's something that I think we talked about in some of the after we saw some of the Hobbit films, and I know that I talked about was that 48 frames per second is simply it's not something that I think that will replace 24 across the board. Mm-hmm. It's just another will may become another standardized tool for your kit, that if you want to make the choice to shoot certain elements, like for Video Game High School Season 2, they shot all of the in real life scenes were all shot in 24, and all of the video game scenes when they're in the video game were shot in 48.
Which I think makes sense, because 60 frames per second I don't think is going away in video games. That's like huge.
That's a standard for competitive gaming.
Yeah.
Sure. And that's a little different for like the reasons why. But I think The Hobbit was a bad example for 48. I'd rather see maybe even just a simple drama in 48.
I enjoy
a good example.
I wouldn't want to see a drama in 48. I want to see a action movie in 48.
Sure. Yeah,
I wouldn't.
That's really come, but I think that's like too much for people. Like it's like seeing all that. We haven't had enough experience filming, you know, with the shaky camera, like because they rely a lot of filmmakers rely on kind of blurring the image, kind of crutching on motion blur to hide people not landing hits and stuff like that. And we've talked about that before, how bad that is, but. Once you lose that, once it's so clear and you can like see every detail, then that way of making a movie breaks down. So you have to reevaluate how to do that.
As opposed to something like sports, which should be that high frame rate because you want to see every detail and where the ball landed.
Yeah, and that's why they're at 60.
Yeah, well, it's not. You're basically doing tricks, and if you can see the trick better, if you can see the sleight of hand, then it's not a trick anymore.
That's a good point.
I enjoy 24 because it feels less real, and I like how movies feel. They're not real.
Kind of like movie grain.
They pull you out of real life, and I like that 24 does that for me, whereas I feel like 48 doesn't.
I think that's a great place to end.
Lots to think about.
Lots to think about. We'll, maybe we'll experiment a little bit and kind of report on what we find.
When we are next on the ISCAST, we will have finished all of our shooting.
Yeah. For Down in Heaven.
For Down in Heaven.
Forever, for life.
There's no more we need to do. We're good.
All right, this is the ISCAST signing off.
Thanks, everybody.